Welcome to Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rathis.
And today we had to change our recording schedule, mostly because my wife is working tonight. And so I'm going to be watching the girls tomorrow. And I've also got a suicide prevention coalition meeting. The details don't matter all that much. Just wanted you to know how cool of a guy I am. So we decided that we would change our recording schedule a little bit and do sort of an on-the-fly Q&A with some of our just most fervent fans, the ones that are engaged on Facebook at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday. And what we've learned so far is that our fans are just so awestruck that they have a hard time, you know, sharing their questions with us. So, you know, the only comment that we've gotten to this point is, "Gah, I can't even think of questions, but you both are awesome." Thank you, Rachel Pruitt Fetters, for that one.
I love Rachel. She's awesome too.
You threw out a couple of suggestions of things that we could talk about. And the one that grabbed my attention the most was making amends, reconciliation. You used different language for it. How did you describe it?
I used what do we do when we mess up? And forgiveness.
Sure. So messing up isn't something that I've got a lot of personal experience with, but I've heard of people who do that.
I'll be our expert today on messing up.
So what I think is interesting about that question is you would think that that is the type of thing that we would be well practiced at. I think that we can forgive people for not communicating well generally, because I don't think that we often put into contexts that allow us to have really productive kinds of conversations. But making amends feels like something that we would have to do all the time, you know, that like you would think that we would be good at it. But it blows my mind sometimes. I'll be sitting down with a couple that's been together for, you know, 100 years, and they do not know how to, you know, name their hurt. They don't know how to say they're sorry when they hurt somebody else. It is just so foreign, I think, to people as an idea. Why do you think that is?
I think that what I see as kind of our default in society a little bit is this jump to blame. And we see it, I mean, we talked about politics last conversation. I think we see it in that. We see it in so many ways of, you know, this happened to me, like this victim mentality. And it's interesting in my teaching people of self-compassion, with self-compassion work, it's kind of this fine, it's a really interesting thing that we walk of. We're quick to blame other people, but then we also blame ourselves really, really deeply. And so I think it's just kind of this like disease of blame that we live into. We jump right on to ourselves with blame, but we also blame other people. So it's not really, it's kind of taking personal responsibility, but it's kind of not. And so I'm not sure we're really good at seeing where am I at fault? Where might I have caused the situation versus why do bad things always happen to me? And why is everybody, it goes back to that fundamental, do you see that everybody's really trying to do their best? Or do you see that everybody is really trying to take you down? If you live in a space where everyone's working against me, then I think you don't see personal responsibility as much as somebody who says everybody's really trying their best and this is hard for all of us. And so then you come at it from a different space.
Yeah.
So blame, I think, is my answer, my long answer to that question.
No, I think it's good. I think it describes the sort of playing field that we're on. It doesn't seem to me that we are by default engaging in a space where we sort of expect the best of ourselves and the people we're relating to. In the 2016 election, I remember reading an article, and this was in, you know, the summer, sort of, I think it was even still during the primaries. And the question was put to this political commentator about, well, what is the right thing for Hillary Clinton to do in addressing the sort of scandal related to her emails being on a private email server? And just this narrative that kept getting brought up. And he said, she just needs to say, I'm sorry, it won't happen again, full stop. And I remember reading that and thinking like, oh my God, that is such a simple thing to do. Why is that so hard? What would be so, because then the narrative disappears, right? Then it is no longer about the defensiveness and was it right and was it wrong. It's no longer trying to justify your actions. And it just gets into a place of, okay, we acknowledge that it was wrong. We say that we're not going to let it happen again. And we'll get into, I'll talk about some of the things that I feel like go into a really essential apology later. But it is, there is something inside of us that prevents taking that responsibility. I remember training once for a summer job and they were like, don't apologize to anybody. If someone like slips and falls, it was at a movie theater, I won't say which one, but they're like, if somebody slips and falls, do not say you're sorry for what happened to them, because that admits guilt, and then you're going to go to jail and they're going to own the theater by the end of it. And again, that sort of that fear that, you know, what could go wrong if I accept responsibility for this? What am I admitting to? What am I agreeing to in accepting fault? That feels tied up in this. You said this idea of like, we blame ourselves and yet we blame them. And it feels like we don't even want to engage this conversation a lot of the time because it just feels so fraught with a lack of clarity. So it's certainly interesting. I think I would wonder, where might we begin? So let's assume we're in a relationship and someone done wrong. What's sort of point A? If point G, or however many points there are, if the last step is that we are reconciled and more connected than ever, what's the first step?
I think that one of the things that came to mind for me is that idea of the question of what am I trying to accomplish? So that end in mind, right? Like, so if Hillary wanted to get elected, then the best thing to get her elected would have been to, you know, handle it the way that you described. I remember what came to mind when you were talking about Hillary is I remember watching, and I just Googled it real quick, Hugh Grant apologized for having an affair, and it was 1995. I think he was on Johnny Carson or whatever the late show was at the time. And I remember he was one of the first people that I was aware of that did a public apology. Mm. And he basically says, we'll have to watch them. There's a YouTube video of it, but he apparently said, I messed up. Mm. And I remember being so shocked by that of like a celebrity is admitting that they messed up. Mm. And then his fan base grew a lot after that. And then it was this whole conversation. I mean, the reason that I remember this happening was because then all the talk shows were talking about, you know, wow, we really got a confession and he really did mess up. He's saying he messed up. He's owning it. And so I think about for Hugh Grant, the end in mind was, I don't want to lose my celebrity status. I want acting contracts. I want movies in my future. I want a following. So the right thing to do would be to apologize. So I think in our relationships, if I want to stay in this relationship, I need to learn to get comfortable apologizing. Mm. I need to own that I'm going to mess up. We are both going to mess up. And so let's get more practiced at apologizing so that it's not this big, scary, looming thing that we struggle to do, because the end goal is that we stay together.
Yeah. Yeah. We so often get caught up in the middle where we're thinking, here are all the things that are going to be difficult about this conversation, where if we actually go to the end, I think I don't know if I've mentioned it before in this context, that sometimes I will say to my wife, are we going to get divorced? No. Okay. Let's work backwards from there. Like even in small minor things where we just say that. Like we know that we want to end up more connected, more, you know, closely connected. So let's work backwards from a place where we say that's the outcome that we want. But if all we're thinking of is like, oh my gosh, like I've got to swallow my pride. I've got to do some self-exploration to understand what I did wrong. And you're describing this from the point of view of the person who needs to do the apologizing. What I tell couples in premarital classes is you should apologize often, but you should forgive more often. And the reason I say that is because the person who does the wrong thing is less likely to understand that a wrong thing has happened. It will be really easy for somebody to just, you know, to make a comment without a full appreciation for all of the things you know, that I've gone into, you know, a situation. So let's say I come into the kitchen and the kitchen is kind of a mess. And so I say, it's like, oh, why is the kitchen so messy? Now, ultimately, that may be not appropriately sensitive if what really happened was my wife just spent an hour and a half trying to make banana muffins with chocolate chips with my daughter and all these other types of things. And instead, and if she's sensitive to the fact that you know, like, again, that could be something that I could apologize for, but it my wife might experience it as problematic, but if she doesn't mention it to me, it may never even occur to me that I had done a wrong thing. Now, I'm not saying that it shouldn't. I'm not saying that I shouldn't be energetic and perceptive and trying to pay attention to the ways in which I might wrong my wife. But it is important for my wife, in as much as she feels like she has the ability and the awareness to be able to bring that to my attention, to be able to say, hey, I just want you to know what this was like for me, and to sort of initiate the process of forgiveness, which will include my apology for sure, but will allow me to fully understand, you know, what this, what it all entails.
I think that I like what you're saying there, because that gets back to, we have to share with our partner that this hurt, mm-hmm. or this, for me, that felt like an attack. So we have to do that initial sharing of the feeling to bring it to our partner's attention. And then I think that the onus is on the partner too, to not jump right into a defensiveness. Mm-hmm. Or a continued attack, right? Because you could say, yeah. Oh, Lindsay, I get that that hurt your feelings, but the kitchen is always a mess, mm-hmm. right? Like, you could go that path, or you could say, oh my gosh, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings. I didn't mean that at all. I was just making an observation, and I'm so, so sorry that, right? So we also have to be ready to not be defensive. Right. I don't know what the word is for that, yeah. but yeah,
I like that. One of the things that I don't know how often I'm able to articulate it the way that I want to. If you say to somebody, I'm not going to fight with you, I'm not going to compete with you, that is a really vulnerable position to put yourself in. So it's like saying, okay, you and I are both walking toward each other with swords drawn, and I'm going to put my sword down. Hopefully the other person also puts their sword down, right? And if they don't, now all of a sudden you're open to a deeper woundedness. And so what it requires, I think, a lot of the time is a mutuality in saying, hey, we're both going to put our swords down so that we can effectively engage in this process, so that we can really get down to the bottom of what is your experience like, what is my experience like, and how can we become more closely connected by the end of this conversation. And that's, again, not our default. Our default is to say, well, let me describe to you all the reasons why what I said was actually okay, why I'm right and why you're wrong. And mm-hmm. that is not a path toward healing. And that is such a hard thing for people to wrap their minds around. But I think it is fundamental to becoming more closely connected as partners. That's, you know, when I work with couples and couples counseling, that's session one, is trying to acknowledge that you have been inculcated in a paradigm of argumentation and conflict, and you are trying to move toward one of connection. And that's what it looks like to sort of lay down your arms, which is saying, hey, I'm not going to be accusatory, I'm not going to be defensive, and instead I'm going to be trying to say things that are going to draw us into closer connection with each other.
And you just, for some reason, Alexander Hamilton jumped in my
brain.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm guessing Rachel likes Hamilton, so I'm glad she's listening. But, you know, the thing, what I was thinking of is that idea of, okay, they come to the duel, right? Aaron Burr and mm-hmm. Alexander Hamilton, and Aaron Burr takes the shot, right? And mm-hmm. and so it doesn't end well for Hamilton.
He dies.
Yeah, he dies. Spoiler.
Spoiler, yeah.
But on that, I think that when I look at that, I'm like, well, that didn't end well to not take the shot. You know, so I think that we also have this fear of, I love the idea that we're in it for the long run and let's both practice civility and let's both put our swords down at the same time. But there is also this like very inherent risk that mm-hmm. the other person takes the shot.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So here's, this is, I'm going to make a historical observation and then maybe be able to draw some actual relational parallels to it.
Okay.
Hamilton threw away his shot, but he did it poorly.
Okay.
So the idea in a duel is that you walk your 10 paces, and then if you just want to defend your pride, you can shoot at the ground. And by shooting at the ground, you're saying, I'm throwing away my shot. I don't actually want to kill you. I just want you to know that this is how seriously I take whatever issue it is. And so then the other person would generally throw away their shot too. Now, what Hamilton did was he shot up in the air. Okay, so he didn't follow the right rules in throwing away his shot. So to his opponent, because his gun was drawn and pointed up at this guy, he was thinking, oh, I'm being shot at. So Aaron Burr, now again, this is one of the ways that that historical narrative goes. So I think it goes to show that even when it is not our intention to be accusatory or defensive, we can still come off as accusatory or defensive. And if that's how our partner perceives us, even if that's not our intention, we can still be wounded. So it requires a lot of intentionality, a lot of careful, thoughtful practice to get to a place where we can engage in those conversations in such a way where when we, quote, throw away our shot, we do so in a way that isn't mistaken as an actual attack against us.
That was good. Good,
right?
I wasn't sure when I went down the Hamilton path, I was like, Ginger, stop.
No, that's fine.
You redeemed it. That was awesome.
That story of Hamilton and his duel is an interesting one. And it's still sort of contested around what actually happened on that fateful day. And, you know, I think it was it Rhode Island where they dueled? I don't remember.
Can't remember, but so, I love that you knew that. That's pretty cool. I didn't realize that rule about dueling too. That's very
I listened to it in a podcast and would welcome any challenge to the accuracy of what I said. I still think the analogy works out, even if it ends up being completely wrong historically.
Yeah, so, I love it.
So
I think the risk that's inherent in apologizing is what we're getting at, right? Of like, it just feels scary to admit that we are wrong. And I think that really comes from we need to build up our own self-assurance and our own comfort with making mistakes, right? Yeah. Of like, you almost build up a tolerance to, yeah, I'm human. I make mistakes. I'm sorry. I'm tired. I snapped at you. And so we have to be able to know that does not mean I'm an inherently bad person. Mm-hmm. And so therefore we never admit our mistakes. We have to know, look, at the core of my being, I am a loving person. I am good, but I lose sight of that sometimes and I make mistakes and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And you know, that comes with some inner work, I think, to build up a tolerance that we have the capacity to apologize.
Yeah. You know, I think part of what we're getting at is this idea that opening up the door to being able to apologize in many ways begins with taking the conversation about apology away from good, bad, right, wrong. You know, I think that in the wake of the Me Too movement, when we have conversations about white privilege in relationships in all of these different contexts, it's so easy to say, I'm not racist. And the reason we want to say we're not racist is because we equate racism with being a bad person. The reason all the people in the Me Too movement wanted to say, well, you know, I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. You know, I'm not a bad person in the way that I was behaving toward these people. And again, it's a can of worms. I don't know that we want to necessarily go into in this context, but I think the reason why that's so difficult is because they don't want to say, well, yeah, I did these wrong things, but I'm not a bad person. That's a distinction that I think as a people, we have a hard time making. One of the more instructive conversations that I had ever heard about white privilege was this woman talking about how you can be racist and still be a good person. Because your racism, generally speaking, is not a function of your morality. It is a product of the way you were acculturated. It was a product of the way you were taught to understand different people, how that shaped the way you behave toward different people, the experiences that you had with people who were different from you. And once you begin to recognize that and say, like, oh yeah, my propensity toward treating people of color differently as a white person doesn't make me a bad person. It just makes me a white person. And if I can start to understand that, then I can be really honest with myself about what are the ways in which I'm not treating people of color with fairness, with integrity, with, you know, the credit that people deserve. I'll let that open the door to what I would consider sort of the four parts of what I call an authentic apology. And the first one is taking responsibility. just saying, I did this thing that was wrong. You know, thoughts, Ginger, on how to do that well, why that might be difficult for us, what we would need to overcome internally, just to say the words, hey, I'm sorry for this thing.
Yeah, I think it, what I was thinking when you were talking about racism leads right into this responsibility piece is, what I see a lot with my work with women on self-worth is that we have this perfectionism that lies in this piece that you were addressing with morality, but this perfectionistic idea that I, Ginger, don't make mistakes. I don't make mistakes. I get it right the first time. I, you know, have to be perfect. I can't make a mistake. And when we're in that space without any self-compassion, without any grace, without any remembering of our core identity that we are good at heart, if I live in a world where I don't make mistakes, then I can't possibly take responsibility for a mistake, right? So, but if I live in a world where, you know what, I'm doing my best today and I'm going to get it wrong sometimes, but I'm going to try again. And I know that if it comes from a place of love, it can't be totally wrong. So I can say I messed up.
Yeah.
I messed up. I'm so sorry. So to me, that taking responsibility piece has a little bit of some precursor work to do.
Sure.
That comes with the admission that I make mistakes and I don't always get it right.
It closes the door to our propensity toward blaming others, towards saying, mm-hmm. Oh, well, here's why what you did was wrong, you know, and instead say, okay, well, I'm going to find the things for which I can take responsibility. And in doing that, I'm sort of opting out of casting blame on you. The second is one that I encourage people to be really careful with, but it is explaining without excuses. And here's the reason why I think this matters. It allows you to demonstrate to the other person that you understand how it happened, so that you know you're talking about the same thing. So it's not saying, well, hey, I was tired, or hey, I was cranky, I was in a hurry. But part of what we do is we say that I sort of understand the conditions that led to this happening. And part of what that equips you to do is some of these second parts, which is, you know, fixing it and taking accountability. But ultimately, it helps you say, because we've all probably been on the receiving end of an apology that didn't feel very authentic, where someone just says, yeah, I'm sorry, whatever, you know, I'm sorry for that thing. Well, tell me why. You know, tell me why you're sorry. Tell me why you were the one that actually did this. The example that I give to people most often is you are carrying groceries through the door. Let's say you've got, you know, just tons of groceries in each arm. And as you walk through the door, you knock over a vase. Okay. And it's your partner's very favorite vase. So step one is acknowledging I'm the one that knocked over that vase, not you put the vase in the wrong place. Not, you know, it was wobbly to begin with. It's I am the one who can take responsibility for that vase knocking over. And explaining without excuses, excuses could look like, you know, well, you know, why did you put the vase there? Someone must have moved it. But explaining is saying, you know, I had too many bags of groceries. I wasn't being sufficiently careful. I wasn't being thoughtful enough. It allows you to demonstrate to your partner that you have put some consideration into the content or the context that led to that outcome.
I think, I love what you're saying. And I think that in my own personal growth, I have to be really aware of that pause between I'm sorry and I know your heart is broken that mm-hmm. I broke that vase. And stop there sometimes mm-hmm. before I go into the I statement.
Yeah.
Right. Because I do think sometimes I don't sit with the person in their feeling long enough before I start making it about me again. And so honoring their pain is really important, and to sit in that a bit before we start, you know, even if we're doing it from a self-deprecating, humble mm-hmm. intention, we switched the spotlight back to us.
Right.
And so keeping that space of you're hurting, I caused your pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stop there. without the excuse. I like what you're saying with the adding that piece of without excuses, mm-hmm. I think is a really important piece of our growth
yeah.
work.
Yeah. It's the, if we think about what an excuse is, and if we just pronounce it differently to excuse as opposed to excuse, an excuse is a thing that excuses something that you've done wrong. So essentially it negates any responsibility taking that you might've done. So as soon as you start to say the light was in my eyes and so I didn't see where I was going, you know, it wasn't my fault kind of thing. Okay, well now it's no longer something that you're taking responsibility for, which is I think what opens our heart to do what you're describing, which is to, you know, if we can say I did this wrong thing, and in doing this wrong thing, and I'm using that language very intentionally, it's not like I am wrong for doing this thing. It's I did this thing and this thing was wrong. It allows us to sort of say, well, what must that be like for my partner? And how might they be hurting in the recognition that I've done this wrong thing? So I think you're absolutely right that there that we have to be, in offering an apology, acutely aware of our partner's experience through that. It's possible that our partner is, you know, depending on the situation, they're ready to receive the fullness of our apology. But it might be having a conversation that looks like, listen, I knocked over the vase and I'm really sorry for doing that. That's 100% my fault. How can I be supportive to you in this space? You know, what does it look like right now? I want to be able to share more about what's going on in my heart, but I also want to make sure that you're getting the support that you need. So I like that sort of intermediary step of first checking in. The third step in the original edition is to describe what we're going to do to make it right. How are we going to work toward restoration of the people who were wronged? And again, we've all sort of seen it done wrong, where we say it's like, yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Okay, well, what are you going to do to make it right? Well, so if you're not really invested in the process of making it right, then you haven't really taken responsibility for it. I mean, that's why my summer movie theater job didn't want me apologizing, was because they didn't want to be on the hook for fixing it. You know, they didn't want to pay for someone's broken hip, so they didn't want us apologizing for the broken hip. So in the vase conversation, it usually looks like, you know, I'm going to painstakingly glue it back together, or I'm going to pay to have it replaced, or how can we engage in a conversation together about what it looks like for this to be fixed?
Yeah, I love that. And asking the other person, how can I fix this for them? Right. And so it's, again, not our ideas about how to fix it, but how the hurt person would like me to fix it. And what would fixing it be to them? You know, how do we define fix it? I think that's worth exploring a little bit too, because what I may think about fixing it is one thing, and what they think is fixing it is a completely different thing. And so getting a little bit of clarity around that. And I think what you bring up with the movie theater example is exactly what we all feel in our own hearts, is a fear of, what is this going to cost me? Right? What is this? What is the fix? How uncomfortable for me is this fix going to be? And so our natural, you know, fear response in our brain is, this could hurt, and let's not do something that's going to hurt. Right. Yeah. So that's just our inherent protection device flaring. And then we have to say, no, we need to sit in the discomfort a bit, Ginger, like to myself, you need to go into this space and make it right. And, yes, it may be uncomfortable for you, but this is how you learn and grow. And so, that piece of course, we're going to avoid the cost, but we have to do that for the purpose we began with, which was, we're in this relationship for the long haul. And I want to honor both of us in this relationship.
Yeah.
So I guess with fix it, to me, would be clarity on what does it mean to fix it. And then my own courage to go into what that fix really means consequence-wise.
Yeah, I think it's, and as we start to dive into this deeper in terms of what's required, I think it gives me more compassion for how hard this is for people. It's easy to say, I'm sorry, whatever, you know, but it's harder to say, yeah, I'm sorry. I did a thing that was wrong. Let me sit with you in your pain. Let me help you understand all the ways in which I did this that was wrong. And let me figure out what, you know, restoration looks like. What does it look like for me to be redeemed in your eyes and for this situation to be restored? Man, again, I know that you and I have had experiences of people not doing this well, and how ultimately sometimes a poorly executed apology that doesn't pay attention to some of these steps can be as damaging as no apology at all. In many ways, because it signals a lack of understanding. You know, so when someone says, you know, oh, I'm sorry if that hurt your feelings. I'm sorry if, you know, the thing that I did upset you. I wasn't really trying to do that. You know, right off the bat, there's an insincerity that comes with apologies like that. And it doesn't often feel to us like that person truly understands the things that they did that were wrong.
I think that brings up kind of a layer of grief a little bit too, of that disappointment of, oh, I thought this was something different than it is. I thought you cared about me more than I'm realizing you do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so then there's that grief of the loss of the relationship and that, and I think that's where we have to be careful. And I'm thinking about women that are in domestic abuse situations and how we have to be careful of that, that disappointment in another person is not a reflection on your lack of worth or your unworthiness, your mistake, your bad, you know, your badness that, and I see that a lot with women that kind of take abuse, and don't get sincere apologies and begin to think I'm not worthy of a sincere apology and I don't matter and my feelings aren't important. And so I think that that is the really hard part. And you're right. It's so complicated. What we're talking about is so complicated. And I think you and I even realized within 30 minutes, we've gone into the hard stuff here in human relationships that you know, we're bringing to the surface, but it's multifaceted and it really, you know, it really shines a light on our own worthiness, our compassion for another person. A lot of those human core values really show up when somebody makes a mistake and how we handle the mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. I was watching Dead to Me on Netflix. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
So there's a recurring dynamic in the show where one of the relationships it's very toxic. There is a man who, you know, is not kind, yells, bullies this woman that he's been in a relationship with. And this back and forth goes, the man yells, the woman says, don't yell at me. The man says, I'm sorry. And the woman says, it's okay. All within the space of about 3 seconds. And it happens, you know, several times throughout the course of this first season. And I just remember thinking, like, we get into those loops with people where we start to convince ourselves that this is what an apology is, that, okay, well, the person apologized. So I no longer, now that they've said, I'm sorry, my job is to say, it's okay. My job is to say, okay, that's fine. And I think part of what you're saying in that is that we have the right to say in a relationship, you know, I'm not seeing what I need to see in this apology. And so part of what us, when we enumerate all of these things that go into a really authentic apology, is for you to know what to look for and what to ask for. Because I think it's difficult sometimes when we know an apology isn't right, but it's hard for us to articulate why. It's saying, like, I don't know that you're actually sorry. And sometimes that can make the other person feel defensive. Like, what are you talking about? I said I was sorry. You know, it's like, well, I'm not hearing you take full responsibility. I'm hearing you shift responsibility. I'm hearing you make excuses. You're not talking about how you're going to fix it. And this last part is looking at what we're going to do to keep it from happening in the future, which is to say, this is how my behavior is going to change. One, to demonstrate that I have a full understanding of how this went wrong, but also to say, I'm committed to changing my behavior so those things don't happen again. So with the vase analogy, this is the moment where you say, okay, I'm not going to come in with as many groceries. You know, I'm not going to try to load up each arm. I'm going to be a lot more careful. You know, I'm going to call ahead of time and ask for help. The first thing that I'll do is I'll come in, I'll move the vase to a safe place. Then I'll go get the groceries and I'll bring those in. Now, so what we see is that in all of those situations, there is sort of a dimension of inconvenience that exists. or at a minimum, it's a change of behavior that might make life more difficult for the person who did the wrong thing. So inviting those types of conversations, saying, well, here's how I'm going to keep that from happening, says that, yeah, I know that what I did was wrong. And because I'm committed to doing the right thing, I can take responsibility for some of the things that might be more difficult moving forward. That it's not just going to be as easy as loading my arms up full of groceries and walking through the front door, that I have to be more careful and more intentional than that.
And I think you're getting at a point too, where we see the change in behavior over the course of time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have to be patient with seeing that, oh, he really was sorry because he really is making the effort to avoid that happening mm-hmm. again. And sometimes that's not always immediate, right? It's the next week when you go back to the grocery store. And I think what came to mind for me is trying to teach this to children. Mm. Because like I see in that loop you were talking about earlier of like, it's okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm over it. I see that with my children of, I want to teach them to get comfortable apologizing and accepting apologies from their sibling. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I see them do what you're saying, which is this a little bit of a mechanical, like, it's okay, no big deal. And, you know, and that's not fair either. Mm-hmm. So I find myself as a parent trying to kind of toe that line of, is it really okay? You don't have to just say it's okay if it's not really okay. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, I don't know, social grace that we teach of, you need to apologize and you need to accept that apology and not hold a grudge and go back to whatever you were doing. And don't ruminate on it and don't keep mm-hmm. score and don't bring it up again. Right. We teach that as parents, but at the same time, teaching them to have a voice to say, this is how it impacted me. This is how it made me feel. I'm struggling to get over it. Mm-hmm. This is what I need you to do. You know, those are more mature conversations, but I think starting to harness some of that at a young age with our children could help.
It's so I have younger children than you. And what I see sometimes is when we sort of indoctrinate those kind of mechanical processes, there will be times when, let's say my 2.5-year-old doesn't share or takes a toy. She doesn't do very much wrong, but when she does something wrong where, and we express upsetness. So let's say, I build a tower out of blocks and she knocks it over and I say, oh, like that makes me sad. I was having fun playing with that tower of blocks. And they'll say, oh, it's okay. Because because they know that the system is she apologizes, I forgive her, and then it's okay. So she just jumps right ahead to, oh no, this behavior is okay because it exists within the scope of apology and forgiveness. So I think that again, and the reality is going back to this loop from that show Dead to Me, is what we end up seeing because those bad behaviors recur is that that's the exact same thing that they're experiencing. It's bad behavior. And then the sort of apology and forgiveness are seen as sort of all absorbed within this same loop. So you might as well say bad behavior, it's okay. Bad behavior, it's okay. The actual apology doesn't carry much meaning. And then the ability to absorb that apology doesn't carry much meaning either because it's just going to continue to recur. So I think that part of what we can do for our children is to start fleshing out these apologies, even if it's only going to be cursory in some cases, even if it feels like overkill in some cases. But I mean, what would it look like if my daughter knocks over the blocks that I was building for me to have a conversation about her? Is like, hey, like this, you know, this made me upset. And then have a conversation with her where I can say, hey, well, what could we do to keep this from happening in the future? And how can you help me rebuild it right now so that it can be sort of restored? And that's all part, it's not a sort of condition of my forgiveness, but it is a condition of being restored to right relationship. And I think that that's what we're describing is we're not saying that you've got to be able to execute these apologies to perfection every time, but that if that outcome, you know, sort of looking, beginning with the end in mind, if that outcome is a restored relationship, that it will need to include most of these elements, if not every time, it will need to include them most of the time, so that we can feel like we're on the same page, like our partners truly do understand us and can appreciate what might have been difficult about what went wrong.
Yeah, and I think that that future accountability piece is exactly what that is. Of, do I really see a change in behavior? You know, did this event make an impact on our future? And that's the important part. I think we all, you know, I feel like sometimes when I get an apology that I'm not sure was sincere, I kind of file it away in my brain as, we'll see, you know, I'll see if this behavior changes. I'll see if you really meant what you said. And so then it just kind of takes time to see how that plays out. But for me, the sincerity of an apology is in a little bit of the long-term behavioral impact.
Yeah. And to that point, I think we can, the less sincere an apology feels to us, the harder it is for us to be in right relationship with a person in the short and medium term, right? Because if we're not sure how sincere that was, then we're going to approach that cautiously. We're not just going to be like, okay, well then let's be best friends again. It's going to be like, well, like, you know, until I have confidence that you actually do understand what went wrong and you're going to do something about it moving forward, I want to be really careful about how I engage with you so that I don't get hurt again.
Exactly.
So I think that those are some of the stakes we're describing when we talk about this. And again, I think a lot of this feels intuitive to us. It feels like, oh, well, all of this makes sense and we would always want to be doing this type of thing. But I think it was good that we opened this conversation with but it's going to be really hard because of the sort of baked in biases we have as people. But hopefully that gives you a sense of what to expect from your partners in terms of an apology, and then how you can be more effective at apologies yourself. Again, in the recognition that you're going to make mistakes. Again, I'm not going to make mistakes, but other people I've been told do sometimes make mistakes. Well, I think that'll about do it for us today. At some juncture in the future, we'll actually, you know, with some foresight, plan out like some kind of live Q&A event. But for now, I think this is a topic you and I both felt comfortable firing from the hip from. Again, my name is James Cochran, and you can find out more about my practice at CompassionFix.com. There's very little you can find out about me at CompassionFix.com. You can find out about my practice at talkingwithjames.com.
And I'm Ginger Rothis, and you can find out more about my work at CompassionFix.com. And James, you are on there. Our podcast is on the website.
Oh, okay. So then you can also find out more about my practice at CompassionFix.com, which will send you to this podcast, which will tell you to go to talkingwithjames.com.
Perfect.
So our episodes drop on Tuesdays and Fridays. Please like and review us on iTunes. It really helps people get connected with our program. And until next time, we hope that you will have a good time and
be well.